on this episode of The Jason Wright Show.
But I always had an interest in human performance and exercise and nutrition, but it didn't exist. In fact, what's interesting is sort of a quick sidebar. Back then, there was nothing. Today, it's at every major university. So literally in a span of like two or three decades, it's exploded. So as a biology major, I remember sitting in my, I took a nutrition course. It was like general nutrition. And I remember the professor, a rather older woman, she said that if you eat a lot of protein, you could probably fill in the blank here. If you eat a lot of protein, it's bad for your kidneys.
Hey folks, real quick before we get started, I have a favor. Will you please go out to jasonrightnow.com and pre-order a copy of The Stone Chiseler? This is a parable about a young Giovanni Cristiani, and it's inspired by Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. This is a book about a young boy who is cast into a prison known as the Stone Yards, where each and every prisoner is tethered to a large boulder, even bigger than them. And the only thing that they're to do for the rest of their existence is to chisel on this boulder, not art, nothing, just to bang away aimlessly in vain at this large boulder before them. However, Giovanni takes a different road. He decides to use this as not a moment just to beat upon a rock or chisel away at a stone, but to chisel away at the man that he will become. With each strike of his chisel, he shapes his character. He shapes his man. He shapes his person. I'm very proud of this book. I hope you will check it out. It's The Stone Chiseler. And again, you can go out to jasonrightnow.com/The Stone Chiseler and you can pre-order your copy now. It will be available for pre-order on Amazon, if not full order on Amazon by February 19th. So please check it out. The Stone Chiseler, jasonrightnow.com/The Stone Chiseler. I would be so honored if you would go grab a copy or pre-order a copy and you'd share in Giovanni's story. I think that we can all relate to Giovanni in some form of fashion. It's finding purpose no matter what the moment is, finding purpose in that moment no matter how dire. So check it out, The Stone Chiseler. And with that, enjoy the show. Folks, today's episode is all about nutrition. You know I love talking about nutrition, and we're going to be talking a lot about supplementation in this episode also. And so I thought, why not remind you that you, the Jason Wright Show listener, you get perks. That's right. If you go to Layer Origin Nutrition, that's layerorigin.com, you get a 15% discount just by using the promo code IMPROVE. Layer Origin Nutrition is where I get my human milk oleosaccharides. That is HMO. That is how I repair and build the lining of my gut. Hey, since I read the immunity code and learned about HMO and what it does for your gut lining and your bifidobacterium, do you realize that I have lost 4% of my body fat? I am down to my perfect weight. You know, I kind of, some of the girls that work for Gemlin up at our store, they were laughing at me the other day because we were talking about goals for the new year and that sort of thing. I said, you know what? Nutrition or trying to improve my overall appearance, health, whatever, weight, that's not a goal this year. It's just to maintain. I have nailed my numbers, and I know a lot of it has to do with HMO, and you can get yours at Layer Origin Nutrition. 15% discount if you use promo code IMPROVE. So Layer Origin Nutrition, layerorigin.com, go get it. And now listen to Dr. Jose Antonio tell you all the wonderful things about creatine and other supplementation and the biology of eating well and supplementing for your health. Enjoy. All right. Doctor, thank you so much for being here, Dr. Antonio. I am so excited to have you. Like I said before we came on, this is going to be just probably all over the map, because I am like a little kid in a candy store. Now that I got your big brain to play with for a little bit, I'm going to be really excited. So thanks for being on the Jason Rice Show, brother. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Jason. I think we'll have good time here because I do have a lot of stories. So let's start wherever you want to start.
Okay. So let's just kind of pick it up where we were going off camera a little bit. So one of the things that I'm starting to see, and this is what led me to you, I'm doing some research for an article that I was writing for my newsletter, the Vitruvian Letter, and I'm researching creatine because creatine is getting a lot more, I guess, appreciation these days for longevity, for overall health and wellness. I mean, it's beyond just bro science and, you know, kind of meatheads in the weight room trying to get jacked. People are really understanding how creatine can be a very vital part of a longevity protocol. And at 46 years old, doc, I'm ready. I want to do everything in my power to maintain youth as long as I can. And so I start researching creatine. I guess I was reading some research about it, and then I found your research. And so I reached out, and you were kind enough to come on the show. So let's start there. And then where I would like to take it is just how vital strength training and then any other supplementation, because that's another thing I want to get into with you. I don't want to just stay on creatine the whole time, although that's kind of what brought us together. You have a wealth of knowledge and information. And like you said, over three decades of researching the different things that work, why they work, what people need. So let's just start right now unpacking, go into kind of your background that led you to dig into the science of creatine. And then let's just take it from there. I'll just start peppering questions because I know it's just going to be, okay. I'll be all over the place. Let's start there.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting story because way back when, we're talking 1980s, when I was an undergrad student at the American University in Washington, D.C., the field of, let's call it exercise science or sports science, whatever, was really quite tiny. If anything, it didn't even exist at most universities. So I was actually a biology major, but I always had an interest in human performance and exercise and nutrition, but it didn't exist. In fact, what's interesting is sort of a quick sidebar. Back then, there was nothing. Today, it's at every major university. So literally in a span of like two or three decades, it's exploded. So as a biology major, I remember sitting in my, I took a nutrition course. It was like general nutrition. And I remember the professor, a rather older woman, she said that if you eat a lot of protein, you could probably fill in the blank here. If you eat a lot of protein, it's bad for your kidneys. And, you know, I'm a stupid undergrad. I'm thinking, that's really kind of an odd thing to say, because when I watch guys, particularly bodybuilders, train and eat, they sure are eating a lot of protein.
Yep.
And nothing's happening to them. So it stuck in my mind. And I'm thinking, that's just the oddest thing. So when I graduated with my biology degree, I went to Kent State University, work with a guy who is one of the pioneers in protein research, Peter Lemon. This is at Kent State University. And he obviously was the first to say, hey, people who work out, we actually need more protein. And at this point, there's just no evidence. There's just no evidence that consuming a lot of protein, you know, certainly more than the RDA, is bad for you. And then from there, I always wanted to get, my goal was ultimately to get a PhD. I actually did my PhD not in, and this is interesting, even though I love sports nutrition, if you told someone, let's say the late 1980s, 1990s, if you told someone, I'm going to do my dissertation on sports nutrition or supplements, they'd laugh at you. They're like, that's bullshit. That's not even a real field. That stuff doesn't even work. So, and I knew that, I'm a very pragmatic person. So I said, well, my second love is skeletal muscle physiology. So I ended up doing my doctoral dissertation on the cellular mechanisms of muscle fiber hyperplasia, or increase in cell number. But even after that, I knew, okay, eventually I'm going to try to figure out how to get back into sports nutrition. So really between I graduated in 1993, I did a postdoc. And then from 1993 to the year 2000, this is where a lot of things really started to change. And going through a couple faculty positions, I noticed that a lot of scientists, actually a lot of everybody, scientists, doctors, dietitians, were still very anti-supplement. And I thought, wow, this is really strange, because it was in the 1990s that a supplement called creatine was introduced, right? Roughly, I think the first papers were in the early 90s. So I thought, wow, this is interesting. Yet, most people in so-called academic institutions still had this really odd view of sports nutrition and sports supplementation. So I remember going to, I don't know if you're familiar with the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. They used to be called the ADA. They have a subgroup called SCAN. Forget what it stands for now. Sports, cardiovascular, and wellness nutrition or something. And I remember the theme of this particular conference was sports nutrition. And one of my good friends, he lives in South Florida, Doug Kalman, he set it up. At the time, he was an RD. He later got his PhD. I was his major advisor for that. But he set up the conference. And I remember at the conference, the people who gave sports nutrition talks, none of them were dietitians. They were all exercise physiologists. So in a sense, sports nutrition as an academic field of study really has its origins not in nutrition, not in dietetics. You can even go back to the 60s when they did the original work on using a muscle biopsy to look at glycogen repletion. It was exercise physiologists, predominantly in the Scandinavian countries, that's really where it originated from, but it exploded starting in the year 2000 up until now. Now, sort of as a sidebar story, during that time, you know, a group of us got together and said, you know what? The American College of Sports Medicine, they don't seem to care about supplements. The NSCA, I mean, they're about strength and conditioning. The Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, or the ADA, they think it's all snake oil. There was a small group of us who said, you know what? There's actually science here. So that's actually how we decided to form the International Society of Sports Nutrition. It really was, there was a market demand for people who thought sports nutrition and supplementation is a legitimate category of research, even though the vast majority of people thought it was like horseshit. So let's fast forward to this year, 2021. Clearly we were right, they were wrong. So that's sort of in a nutshell, you know, I went from a biology major to now I'm the CEO of the ISSN. And the field of sports nutrition, it literally has exploded in the last 20 years. And you can go now to any university in the United States, and I guarantee you, there is a sports nutrition course, which you go back 20, 30 years, they would have laughed at you. Like, what's sports nutrition? Gatorade? Protein? Yeah.
Dr. Antonio, whenever I was growing up, like, because I went through that whole era. I was a college student during that whole era. And in the 90s, whenever I bought my first bottle of creatine, because that's when, you know, we all wanted to get jacked and we didn't care what we were putting our bodies back then. And also, if you wanted to do anything like that, you would be a kinesiology major because you wanted to be a PE teacher, maybe, or you just didn't know what the hell you wanted to do. Well, I'll be a kinesiology major. So it's so crazy hearing you discuss this timeline, because I'm like, yeah, I lived that. And everything you're saying, I remember having people say, what are you taking? And everything was, wait, is that steroids? You know, what is it? Yeah. I remember having a football coach in like eighth grade get so nervous because I brought my first bottle of amino acids. It was like, whoa.
I love that. Hey, creatine's a steroid. It's like, everything's a steroid. That's really strange.
Exactly. So that's amazing. Okay, so continue, please.
Yeah, so literally, you know, like today, going back to like year 2014, 2015, that professor that I had as an undergrad stuck in my mind, you know, when she said, you know, all this protein's bad for your kidneys. And so I was having this random conversation with a bodybuilder in one of my classes, and I noticed, and you could relate to this, he always carried a jug of water. He was always eating during class.
Of course.
I'm like, dude, if you actually studied as much as you ate, you'd probably get an A. But anyways, I asked him, how much do you eat? Like, and you know, bodybuilders, probably more so than any other research subject I work with, are so good at telling you exactly what they eat. They're the only group. Everyone else are like, let's see, I had Fruit Loops and maybe I had a sandwich. I mean, they don't know what the hell they eat. Right. So he went through his mental Rolodex and he told me how much he ate and how much protein he ate. And I'm like, wow, that's actually a lot of protein. And it sort of stuck in my head. Obviously, there's a lot of guys and girls who do the same thing. So I thought, you know what? Why don't we just do a fun little study where we ask people to consume 2 grams of protein per pound of body weight. And that was the initial study we did on high protein diets that I think was published in 2014. And we changed nothing. We didn't change their training. We said, do what you normally do, but we're going to give you free protein powder. And we just want you to jack your protein intake up. And I don't know if you're aware of the results, but surprisingly, nothing happened. Like nothing. They didn't get fat. They didn't get skinny. They didn't, nothing. Which is kind of surprising because they ate a lot more calories. But as you know, protein has this crazy high thermic effect. I remember some of these subjects complaining that they were constantly hot, constantly sweating. So that was, you know, that was really interesting in that we found nothing happened until we did the follow-up study where we had them change their training to be more traditional bodybuilding training. And we kept protein intake high, but not as high. We dropped it from 4.4 grams per kilo to roughly 3.4 grams per kilo, which is still really high. Because in the first study, so many people dropped out. It was like, oh, I can't do this. It's hard to eat this much. It's hard to drink all these shakes, which is true. I mean, I honestly, I tried it for a day. I'm like, I can't do this. 2 grams per pound, I cannot do. Some guys can do. Some guys find it easy. Even some girls find it easy. I'm like, I don't like protein. I love protein, but I don't love it enough to do 2 grams per pound. So in that second study where we had them all follow a traditional split routine bodybuilding type training, you know, is back buys, chest, shoulders, tries, you know, legs, and we just had them rotate. They both the control group and us, super high protein group, gained lean body mass, equal amounts, which tells you maybe there's a threshold for the amount of protein you need to gain lean mass. But the more interesting thing was the group that consumed the higher protein intake lost more fat mass. And that was surprising because, again, remember, they're eating more calories. So that really formed the bread and butter of some of the high protein diet work we did. And then we followed it up with just safety data, looking at like 1 year consumption of high protein intake, no effects on kidneys, no effects on liver, no effects on bone mineral density in women. But as you're well aware, the University of Google PhDs, of which there are many, there are a lot of Facebook PhDs, Instagram PhDs, and Twitter PhDs, said that even if you do a study for a year, and we actually did a 2-year study following up some of these bodybuilders, he goes, even if you do it for that long, we still don't know if it's bad for you. And I'm thinking, you do realize that it's almost impossible to get anyone to do anything for a few months, let alone a year, and that you're never going to get that 10-year study. Everyone's like, well, why don't you do a 10-year study? I'm like, 10-year? Who does 10-year studies? Right. So it's funny how the goalposts always change. The people who are, for whatever reason, are eternally skeptical that all that protein, you know, they think it's got to be bad for you, which is really weird. It's like, why is the default for protein always that if a lot of it is bad for you? And I think what's interesting is a lot of us who work in the sports sciences, well, not including me, but a lot of them come from sort of the traditional exercise science, undergrad and then master's and PhD. I come from more of a biology background initially. One of my most, and this is a, I think, an interesting sidebar, one of my more interesting classes as an undergrad was basically an evolutionary biology class. And I try to look at a lot of these things from an evolution standpoint, because in essence, evolution explains a lot of the things that humans can do. When you think about high protein intake from an evolution standpoint, think about this. If you go back more than 10,000 years ago, this would be the pre-agricultural revolution. Humans were basically hunter-gatherers, right? They were nomadic. They were looking for food. You're not going to survive on stuff you pick off the ground or off a tree. You got to eat animals, right? So typically humans hunted. So imagine this. You're part of a small tribe of 12 to 20 people. You haven't eaten in a day, maybe 2 days. You're hungry as hell. Someone kills a deer, brings it back. Think of this evolutionarily. Do you think the human body tells you, hey, you've hit 30 grams of protein in one sitting? You better stop. It's like, wait a minute, I'm starving. I haven't eaten in 2 days. No, humans, they're good at gorging. So what do? You gorge. Now, if we wasted all that protein, because people are like, oh, you're wasting all that protein. If we literally wasted it, we would be dead as a species. We wouldn't exist. So from an evolutionary standpoint, a lot of the claims made about protein is bad for your kidneys. You can only have 30 grams at one sitting. If that was true, we would not survive as a species. Humans, Homo sapiens would be dead. So I think a lot of the traditional sports science experts, they sort of forget the evolutionary backdrop to which, you know, why humans do what humans do. And I try to do that all the time with a lot of this, whether it's high protein intake, whether it's just looking at exercise adaptation. Does it make evolutionary sense? And I think that's important, and it tends to get lost.
I could not agree more. And the more research I do, the more people are starting to become aware of the fact that we have to go back to our ancestral roots to figure out, because you're in Florida. I mean, can you imagine? Yeah. If they went out and just gathered a bunch of oranges, now not knowing the effects of too much fructose on their insulin levels, they probably just gorge out. But no, protein is what sustained us as a species for so long. So abso-freaking-lutely. And yeah. So, and then whenever you talk about, like, let's just, and again, you know, not to pick on vegans or vegetarians, but some of, we've seen what happens when you really pull back on the protein. For example, talking about creatine, I had someone who said, you know, I'm thinking about going vegan for a while. What are your thoughts? And I said, well, first of all, I don't recommend that because I do believe in to have proper regeneration, you need animal proteins. That's everything I've read. Now, it's not my opinion. It's just the science I've read shows that there is a regenerative effect to animal proteins. I said, but not only that, you're not going to get the creatine that you need, which comes from particularly red meats. And you correct me if I'm wrong, doctor, that you're not going to get that. So you better supplement with some creatine or something because you're missing it. And that's the thing too, that I think that back, like what you're talking about, given a historical reference to supplementation research and adaptation and that people just basically giving it the respect it deserves, they never stop to think about, okay, if you don't eat this thing, that means that you're not getting this thing. So you better supplement somewhere. And also you can enhance performance. Let's take our evolutionary needs. We know what we needed. If we can actually up that a little bit, like with creatine and those sorts of things and extra protein powders, you know, whether it's whey or whatever the case may be, why wouldn't you do it? But it's amazing how people just kind of, they don't even want to look back on how we survived as a species. So yeah, that keeps coming up over and over.
Yeah, there's not just with vegan, but a lot of diets, there's a really dogmatic attitude about a lot of them where if you take vegans, for example, I'm asked, well, can you get enough protein on a vegan diet? And the answer to that is yes, it's just really hard. Can you get any creatine on a vegan diet? No, you can't. It's just not possible. And we know, I mean, the science of creatine is it's profound. It's huge. The benefits to it, in fact, the benefits to it are actually much better in vegans. If you look at the data on vegans and vegetarians, you know, if you're a vegan or vegetarian and you want to improve cognitive capacity, lean body mass, everything, creatine is actually the single best supplement you can take. I think the issue they have is like, well, did they derive it from animals? And it's weird because it's not even a question I would even ask myself. I'm like, is it derived from animals? I mean, what difference does it make? It's the molecule of creatine. So that's, you know, that's interesting in that, not to correct you, but fish actually has higher levels of creatine than beef.
I did not know.
If you're a fish eater, in fact, I tell people, you know, who are very anti or scared of creatine, I always ask them, well, do you eat fish? And of course, well, in South Florida, a lot of people eat fish. Maybe in Nebraska, no one eats fish. But, you know, if they say, yeah, I eat fish, well, then you're eating creatine. And also I get questions regarding high school athletes. It's like, should not, you know, my son or daughter consume creatine? And I always turn the question around. I say, do you think they should consume fish? And they're like, well, yeah, because fish is super healthy. I say, well, fish has creatine. In fact, fish has more creatine than beef. They're like, oh, okay. Well, I mean, you wouldn't tell your son or daughter to limit their fish intake, would you? Fish is one of the best single foods you could eat. So when I put it within the context of eating fish, all of a sudden it's like, oh, I guess this stuff is pretty good. So it depends how you, it's like, I've learned how to frame the story.
Yeah.
Because if it's just like, here's creatine powder, take it, it's good for you. They're like, oh, this is powder. It's a steroid.
Right, exactly. So it's for meatheads. Well, yeah. Is there a particular fish that's better than that's more heavy on creatine?
I think herring might have the most.
Okay.
And there's a lot in salmon and tuna and whatnot, but I think herring might be the highest. But fish in general, there's more creatine in there than in beef, for instance.
Right, right.
But either way, like for instance, I've been taking roughly 3 grams of creatine daily since, let's see how much history you know, Jason, since when Bill Clinton was president. When was that?
That was 90s, man. So I'm
there you go. There you go. That's how long I've been taking it.
Well, okay. So, and I've now, I'm 5 grams a day myself. And just because I've now made it a standard, I got off creatine. Whenever I was younger and I would take it, probably with some of the other stuff I was mixing with, it would kind of upset my stomach whenever I put it in my shake.
You take a powder or a capsule? Yeah,
a powder. Okay.
That's so what you mixed it with other stuff.
I did. And back then I didn't know any better. I remember I was mixing it with a high fructose juice. Like it'd be part of my pre-workout. It was probably just some stupid thing I read in Flex magazine or something that, I don't know why I did what I did, but let's take it like this now, since we're on creatine. Okay. Let's talk about what is some of the science, some of the biology of what's happening with your ADP and ATP as it relates to creatine, and then why it's so important to generate the energy that it gives you. And then let's take it from there. Let's just kind of like, and you tell me if there's a better way to do this, because I think that I want to kind of connect the dots between creatine, energy production, strength production, and then why it is so important. Because here's the thing that I can almost guarantee you, Dr. Antonio, there are people out there listening that all they care about is weight loss. They think that gaining muscle strength, they'll say, I'm 55, I'm 60. I don't need to be gaining muscle. And that is so antithesis to what is true of good health. Am I right? So,
there's sort of a funny sidebar story. I actually have a student who we've talked about weight loss, weight gain and whatnot. And she's doing sort of her own case study, trying to lose weight. Right. And I think I've mentioned protein, creatine and whatnot. And she looks at me, she goes, I don't really care if I lose lean body mass. And she's young. And I said, wait, so you just want to lose weight and you don't care what the weight is? She's like, yeah, I just want to lose weight. I'm like, okay. It's funny because I don't hear that often. So I'm thinking, okay, I need to change the strategy here because you actually don't care what you lose. You just want to lose stuff. So you don't care. Yeah. And she's like, yeah, I don't want to lift weights. I don't care if I lose muscle. I just want to be little. Yeah. So there are people like that, Jason.
I know. I'm sitting here. So my mom and my dad, my mom just turned 70. My dad is going to turn 70, I guess next year. And, they don't do a lot of weight training anymore, either one of them. And my mom had a stroke a couple of years ago. And I'm like, the single best thing you can do is add lean body mass. You've got, and it was kind of, they didn't realize that because they're physical therapists even. They're physical therapists
that.
No. I mean, they're physical therapists that come to help them. Like my mom after a stroke.
They don't know that?
There's not a strong, I don't think, resistance training. And here's something too. Okay, let me take a sidebar here. I want your opinion because my mom was asking, what should I ask my physical therapist to do? And I said, well, you definitely want to make sure there's a strong resistance protocol as part of whatever. The stretching, flexibility, and balance, yes, but also make sure there's a resistance component. Let me ask you this, Dr. Antonio. Do you think for older people, and don't let me get too far away from what we were, but I told you I'll be all over the place. Do you think for older people that are probably more susceptible to injury from heavy weight, the joints and everything, they're just a little more brittle. What do you think about blood flow restriction training for someone who's older to get, to get a little bit more strength out of a lighter workout? Am I thinking that might make sense, or is that right? Or what do you think?
Okay. It's a nuanced question, and here's why. I sort of create this, hierarchy of simplicity. Well, for someone who is older, what's the priority? They got to exercise. So that's number one. Okay. Now it goes to what type and how much. And this is where, resistance training is one of the best, perhaps the best single way of training, right? For maintaining bone health, et cetera, et cetera. But what if they don't want to lift? Okay. Well, then the exercise choice should be, and this is just like diet, I take a very pragmatic view. What can they stick with? Is it weight training? They say no. Is it walking or hiking? They say no. Okay, so you just got to go through this Rolodex of what would they stick with? Because I learned a long time ago that oftentimes telling people what the best thing to do isn't always what they want to do. Same with diets. It's like, I think this diet will work best for you. And they're like, well, I don't want to do that. I'm like, okay, well, here's some other options. So diet and exercise, because I have my own personal opinion and biases about what would be best. Let's say if someone said, hey, my family, we're prone to osteoporosis. What should I do? I'm like, you should lift. I don't want to lift. Okay, so if you don't want to lift, we got to figure out what the second best or third best options are. So it really kind of depends what your parents want to do or what they like to do. Like, for instance, sort of a personal story. All through college, grad school, I was a gym rat. I loved to go to the gym, et cetera, et cetera. I moved to South Florida. It's warm all year. I want to be outside. So what do? I haven't lifted regularly probably since I moved to South Florida. What do? I paddle all the time. So I'm literally on the water, like actually the last few years I've counted how many times I paddle. I paddle probably like 300 times a year. And for those people who've never paddled, it's kind of a weird, it's part cardio, part weird resistance training, and great core work, obviously.
I was about to say, a lot of stability, man, because yeah. I look like an idiot when I try to do it.
Right. And you know what? I never even think about that part because I do fall a lot. I'm like, hey, you fall a lot. I'm like, yeah, because it's choppy out there.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I'm thinking my earlier weight training may have contributed to my higher bone mineral density because I DEXA myself. We have a DEXA in the lab. I DEXA myself. I'm like, hey, I literally haven't lifted for 15, 20 years. All I do is paddle and my bone mineral density is already high. Now, would it be high if I never lifted? I don't know. I actually don't know. But going back to what will I stick with? I no longer, because I live in South Florida, I no longer want to go inside to exercise. I want to be outside. So like this morning, I was outside paddling, got like about an hour and 15 minutes in. So I think the key is rather than picking what's the best thing for you, it should be what are you going to stick with? And that's where I think any form of exercise is best. And again, if you go back to your data, if you're to pick one thing, you know, it's either weight training, single best thing, because it sort of encompasses everything. It helps with activities of daily living. And maybe secondary to weight training would be some sort of, you know, cardio like rowing, where it's still some resistance training, but there's some cardiovascular aspect to it. But then again, people are like, I hate rowing. I'm like, okay, well, you hate rowing, you hate lifting. Let's see, we got to figure out what you like to do. And so that's how I approach it. Now, I don't know if physical therapists per se are trained to teach people what is best for what you're asking for.
Yeah,
they just want to. I always say physical therapists are, they get people who are somewhat injured or they're not quite at 100% capacity, and they bring them to what I call baseline.
Yeah.
And to you and I, baseline is like, baseline, I feel like a fat slob. I don't want baseline. I want to be good.
Yep.
So that, I think that's where personal trainers are much better suited at it than physical therapists.
Yep. Makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. So, well, that helps because what I'm trying to, because I'm not a personal trainer. I'm just someone who studies this stuff religiously for my own health and wellness. And I do some coaching as far as like overall health and wellness coaching and coaching, but I'm not a personal trainer. But I think that I almost want to use my mom and dad as guinea pigs because I want to help them. I want them to, especially, I mean, my dad used to be really into resistance training for years and years and years. And then he just, you know, as age caught up and you know, it's just not there anymore. Okay.
So he never substituted anything else for it.
Not really. I mean, he still does some. I mean, my gosh, at one time it was like an infomercial museum at the house. He had so much of it. He would actually use it. But now, I mean, I don't know what he's doing. I really want to get more engaged with that process for them. But okay, I want to go back to what is happening physiologically whenever we introduce creatine. And here's what has helped me so much, Dr. Antonio, that I think might help the listener. When I actually know, because you said earlier, well, here, take creatine. That's a powder. I don't know. That might be a steroid. As I understand what is happening when I put something in my body at a molecular level, at a cellular level, whatever, when I start to then there's something that draws me, it makes it easier, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, I know if I turn the key to a car and it starts and it fires out, then okay, I just understand what's going on and I can listen for things that might be going wrong. Great example. My car is downstairs. The battery is dead. And I knew yesterday, whenever I was cranking, it was a little slow to start. I was like, I need to go right to the dealership right now. It's not going to start. And damn it, I was right. But I could listen for those keys. It was just a little hesitation. Same thing with the body. When you put stuff in, like now that I know more of what's happening inside whenever I consume creatine, I'm much more likely to stick with it. And then I've got that part, then it's knowing the benefits of strength. And you just said something I really want you to touch on here, because I think a lot of people miss when they hear you and I talk about strength training. They don't understand what it's doing for their bone density, which is so important, especially in older age, right? So just kind of take us through what's happening whenever we consume the creatine, and then why that's important, and just from there.
Okay, starting with creatine. First, let me dispel one myth about it. It's not just water weight you gain. When you consume creatine on a regular basis, you'll gain lean body mass, of which it's not just water, it's actually the proteins in skeletal muscle. You get more actin, you get more myosin. So there's a direct effect on creatine in terms of building muscle protein. The other one, which you alluded to in terms of energy systems or bioenergetics, when you consume creatine monohydrate, which is the primary form that's sold, it increases the amount of creatine in your muscles, but also increases the amount of what's called phosphocreatine or PCR in your muscles. That contributes to the energy systems that are called the phosphagen energy system, which is used for short duration, high intensity type exercise. So by increasing the total amount of creatine and phosphocreatine, you're able to do high intensity, short duration exercise much better than if you had not taken it. So there's that effect. So for instance, you know, the analogy is, let's say you're doing 5 sets of 10 reps of a bench press. Not only will you be slightly stronger, but also the amount you fatigue as you go to the latter sets will be less, because you just have more stored ATP, phosphocreatine, and creatine. So from a bioenergetic standpoint, that helps quite a bit. So think of any sport that's a short duration. Sprints, high jump, long jump, triple jump, all the field events, discus, and then take powerlifting, even bodybuilding, at least bodybuilding training. All of those kinds of events, because they rely so much on the stored phosphagens, ATP, PCR, and creatine, will be enhanced when you consume creatine. Now, there's actually data showing creatine helps endurance events, primarily, like there's a lot of data on rowing, and you're like, rowing is kind of a weird endurance event, because if for anyone who's ever rowed competitively, I never have, but I know people have, there is a large cardiovascular component, but there's also a large component in terms of lean body mass. You cannot be, put this way, just because you have a strong heart doesn't mean you'll be a great rower. You have to have lean mass.
Right.
Creatine actually helps that particular endurance event. So it's not just strength, power stuff it helps. It helps those endurance events based on you gain lean mass, which is actin and myosin. You also get an increase in the ATP, phosphocreatine, and total creatine and skeletal muscle. And not to geek out too much, but have you ever heard of satellite cells, Jason?
No.
Okay. Satellite cells, what happens is, let's pretend a muscle is a cylinder, even though it really isn't. If you look under a microscope, they're never cylindrical, but that's how cartoons are drawn in anatomy books. So muscle fiber is a cylinder. On top of each muscle fiber, you have what are called satellite cells. They're basically what you call repair cells. So let's say you do heavy lifting, heavy eccentric loading, you know, you get delayed onset muscle soreness, you damage muscle. Those satellite cells get activated. And when they activate, what they do is they repair muscle. So if you damage muscle, it repairs it. But also there's two other things that it does. One, it can increase the size of that fiber, hypertrophy.
Okay.
And if you train really crazy enough, it can increase the number of muscle fibers. That's called hyperplasia. So creatine also activates satellite cells. So you got those three things. Creatine activates satellite cells. It increases ATP, phosphocreatine, and creatine. It increases actin and myosin. So those mechanistic things explain, you know, a lot of the performance benefits of creatine.
And so therefore, if you are someone, let's say, that is older, and you're looking for strength, you're looking for good health in your older years, well, this can enhance some of the, just the natural wear and tear on your body. The creatine can start to supplement and come in and repair quicker and lead to quicker recovery, and then adding the mass, right, that you need.
Yeah, and in fact, all those reasons that I gave you, none of them are actually the reason I take it. So I kind of forgot why I took it. So for instance, I weigh, I'm like 5'8", I'm about 185 pounds, and I've been weight stable for forever. I have no interest in gaining weight. Maybe I should lose weight, but I don't really want to, so I'm at 185. It's not going to change. The reason I take creatine is actually for my head, my brain. There's good data showing creatine affects cognition. It affects memory. Some really cool data on people who are sleep deprived. If you're sleep deprived, not that I'm sleep deprived, but it's kind of cool that when you sleep deprive people and they're on creatine, their brains function better than when you're not on creatine. Also, and not that I get traumatic brain injury, but it's a prophylactic in limiting the amount of brain trauma. If, let's say, you get in a car accident, or, you know, I have friends my age who like to fight, meaning they'll go into a boxing gym and like, I'm like, you guys, you're like older and you're getting punched in the head. This is fun. You know, they like doing stuff like that. I'm like, okay, well, you might want to protect your head. And they do take creatine and whatnot. So that's actually why I take it. And it could be subjective, but then I read the data. The data says, okay, better cognition, better memory, blah, blah, blah. My head feels better on it. And so to me, I don't know, as I've gotten older, my priorities change a bit. One, I don't know if I'll get much faster doing what I do. And I don't know if I'll get much stronger. I just want to feel good when I do it. Yep. And sort of minimize, you know, because, hey, let's face it, age always wins. But yep, you're trying to minimize that decline. And what really sucks is I know how quickly I recovered when I was in my 20s. And I'm like, God, I'm like, God, I'm not 28 anymore. It's like a real slow warm-up going from the bed to the coffee maker. I'm like, man, I wish my body was 28. I'll take my brain at, you know, I'm 59. I'll take my brain at 59, but my God, my body. Come on, let's get to work.
So. I'm with you, man. And that's kind of where I am. I'm in the same position. I don't care about, you know, getting ripped or anything like that. It's all about longevity. And that's one of the reasons why I dove so deep into creatine. I did not know, if you would have asked me a year ago, because I'd taken it off and on, but it was not a staple supplement. But then whenever I started understanding and learning about these, especially the cognitive benefits of it, because that's one of the things I think, again, a lot of people lose sight of when they hear guys like you and I talk. I don't know about you, but one of the things that pisses me off is when people look at me with a more fitted t-shirt and go, oh, you've been working out? Well, hell yeah, I've been working out for over 20 years. What are you talking about? Do you brush your teeth? You know, it's not just some novel thing. It's like, why would you not do these things? And so for me now, it is a shift. It's wanting to just slow the aging process. You know, like I read anything David Sinclair is putting out, a lot of Peter Attia's work, you know, those, you know, now I'm doing a lot of your research, because one of the things I'm just now starting to do again, and this is where I want to go now, since we've really, I think, nailed down some of the benefits of creatine, what is some other supplementation that you have added to your mix what your cocktail look like, and talk us through that. And man, I want to know what, I mean, am I going to give you, I mean, I won't bore you with my laundry list of stuff I'm taking, but I would like to know if there's something I needed to add to the protocol.
Yeah. Although if there's a single supplement everyone should take, I always tell people it's creatine.
Yep.
That the one, in fact, more than a multivitamin. I know a lot of people, they always take a multivitamin. I'm like, more important than a multivitamin, take creatine. Yep. It's good for so many things. So that's number one. Now for me, because I do a lot of paddling, so a lot of what I do is to improve that. Coffee, I don't know if you're a coffee consumer, but coffee, not just the caffeine in it, but coffee is actually one of the healthiest beverages you can consume. There's a lot of data, it's observational data, because you can't really do a randomized controlled trial, showing that regular coffee consumption decreases the risk of many, many different kinds of cancer. But that's not why I drink it. It's just sort of, hey, that's kind of a nice side effect. I drink it because I like it. And it helps, you know, helps me wake up in the morning. I also take glucosamine for my joints.
Okay.
Some people say, well, what about glucosamine and chondroitin? And that's fine too. But even when you look at the data, it seems like glucosamine by itself works just as well as glucosamine plus chondroitin sulfate in terms of promoting joint health. So that's another one. Protein, obviously I take supplemental protein, but primarily I do it post-workout. In fact, like post-workout today, I had Fairlife makes this 42 gram shake. It's for me, it's the easiest way to get 42 grams of protein is doing that shake. So I do supplemental protein.
And what kind of protein do you do, Dr. Antonio?
It's almost all whey.
All whey?
Yeah. And in fact, the food technology now is so advanced that the best tasting protein, in my opinion, is almost always whey. I've tried soy. It's like, casein, a lot of the plant-based stuff. I'm like, I'll try it, but the taste I don't like. Now, that's my personal bias. I know people who won't touch whey protein. They say it makes their stomach feel weird. I'm like, okay, well then just use another protein. You don't have to use whey. So that's, so I do that. I take a zinc magnesium supplement, primarily because it actually helps a little bit with a delayed onset soreness. So you don't get as sore. So that's one benefit. I also take, and this is technically not a supplement. I actually been taking a baby aspirin probably for the last, my God, 20 years.
Really? For your mom, or like due to keep clotting? Is that why you're
doing? It's, one, there's data on aspirin decreasing risk of cancer, which is kind of interesting, but also as a preventive for, blood clotting, prevent heart attacks. Not, and here's the thing, it's not like there's heart disease in my family, but I thought, you know what? What the heck? I'll try it, see what happens. And, up until now, knock on wood, I've been quite healthy. So so I stick to the basics, creatine, protein, glucosamine, aspirin. Coffee is not a supplement, but I use caffeine pre-race. So I'll use, a caffeine pill. So that's it. I mean, it's, basic stuff.
Okay.
Now, I like my wife, she's a competitive duathlete. She's actually, I think, nationally ranked. She takes beta alanine, which I suggested to her. I don't like beta alanine. I don't like what it does. I feel weird.
Wait, tell me about beta alanine. I don't know anything about that one. Tell me about it. Okay. Why is she taking it? What's it doing?
Okay. Beta alanine is an amino acid. It's a non-essential amino acid. It combines with another amino acid in the body called histidine. When beta alanine and histidine combine, it forms a compound in your muscle called carnosine, not carnitine, carnosine. Carnosine acts as a buffer, meaning the harder you train and the more lactate you produce and the acidity in your muscle, carnosine will help buffer that. So you actually can train harder.
Got it.
So beta alanine is actually used by a lot of like track athletes, mixed martial arts fighters, things like that. So that's one I'd highly recommend if you're interested in performance. The other one would be nitrates or beetroot juice. It improves blood flow and certainly can help with events that are endurance in nature. So she also takes that. Now, I should take that because I do these paddling races, but I don't win any races. She wins races. I'm like, I'm just trying to finish middle of the pack. That's my goal. So does it really matter if I take that? Nah, probably not, but for her it matters because it means whether she finishes first, second, or third. So it's sort of, you have to decide where you are, what your goal is. If your goal is to win, wow, that's a lot different. I've never been talented enough to win. I just want to do better than I did maybe the last time I did, So beta alanine and the beetroot juice, I think, are great supplements for performance.
Okay. And now, don't you think, of course, you've been in Florida, and not to run down a political trail, I don't want to do that, but the bottom line is, do you not find it amazing that all the things that we're talking about, it hardly gets brought up?
Stop you there. Yeah. And vitamin D, I take.
Oh.
This might sound weird, but I'm out in the sun all the time, and I also take vitamin D. So
it's a perfect segue to what I was talking about. Don't you find it amazing that we don't hear more in the era of COVID about getting out in the sun and doing these things that are so detrimental? Because, and here's where I'd like you to take this, or just kind of get your response. I was watching, so Peter Attia was talking to Joe Rogan, I guess, earlier this week, and he said that exercise alone gives us a 5x reduction in death for any reason. I mean, you take them all. If you will just get out and exercise and move, and then you put in, then you add to that healthy vitamin D, getting in the sun, doing these other things, the benefits, again, what I want to do on this program, you know, the objective is to improve always and always, right? So I'm hoping that people that listen to this, most of them probably have some sort of a workout protocol, and they hear you and that you're going to be on the show, and they go, oh, they're like me. I want to learn some more, so get some more tools for my bag. Yes. But some of them are listening to this and they're going, why would I exercise? I mean, again, I'm going to try to lose weight. I drink a lot of water, you know, they don't. So kind of give from an academic and a biological standpoint, the benefits of just what exercise can do for one's health beyond just looking good.
Okay. There's a lot to unpack there, and I have a lot of ideas and opinions.
Yep.
Let's go. Let's deal with the public health message that we've heard for 2 years. It sucks. In fact, nothing has pissed me off. Well, there's a lot of things that's pissed me off, but this really pisses me off. For the last 2 years, I have not heard anyone who, all the so-called public health experts on TV, talk about you got to work out because exercise is the single most important behavior you can do to improve health. In fact, nothing comes close. Peter Attia is right. Now, it's funny. I think I watched that podcast because I listened to some of, and I'll tell you the parts I disagree with Peter, but exercise.
I want to hear those, so keep going. But
exercise is the single best thing you could do. Nothing comes close. And have I heard a public health expert talk about that? No, not at all. Vitamin D is critical. If you live north of, I think, the latitude of Atlanta in the winter, you're getting no vitamin D. You could lay out naked in Minnesota. You ain't getting vitamin D. Right. And we know there's correlative data, particularly with regards to vitamin D levels in COVID and poor outcomes, et cetera, et cetera. It's good to have high vitamin D levels. So to me, the public health message, imagine 2 years ago, if the public health message, in addition to all the things they were saying, were, hey, go out and work out, lose weight, because let's face it, the United States is a fat country. And I tell my students this all the time. I say, do you realize that if you exercise in your normal weight, you are in the minority in this country, which is really
crazy.
It is so weird. I'm like, that to me is so weird. So you're in the minority. Exercise, maintain normal weight, try not to eat a lot of junk. I think exercise can offset some of the junk. I mean, if you're young, everything offsets, youth will offset a lot of things. But, you know, you're entitled to eat crap every now and then, but eat well most of the time. Get adequate protein intake so you maintain lean mass. The one thing that Peter Attia said that, and I think I may even commented on the podcast, it was on YouTube, I was listening to it, I'm like, huh. He actually gave very specific exercise, I guess a very specific exercise prescription for longevity. And this is where it gets interesting, because when people ask me, hey, would I change the way I train or eat if my goal was just to live long? Let's say that's your goal. You just want to live long. And my answer is almost always, yeah, you know, actually I would, if that's my goal, even though consciously you sort of want to do that. But you know, when I get up and work out, my goal isn't like, God, I want to live long. It's sort of like, hey, I feel better doing this. So if the goal is to live long, it's not to do, I think he had mentioned what level of cardio it was, like level 3 or level 4.
I know. It's a zone 2. And then it's 4x4 of the all out. Okay. I'm with you.
Of the high intensity interval training. And I'm watching this. I'm saying to myself, no, that's not true. If you're training for an event, if you're training for an endurance event, you typically do what's called an 80-20 rule. 80% of the training is volume training, 20% is high intensity interval training. That's how you train. If the goal is longevity, if you look at the blue zones around the world, you know, Okinawa, Loma Linda, around the Mediterranean, those people aren't training. They're not doing squats. They're not running. They're active.
Yeah.
And there's a difference. They're not training for anything. They just don't sit around a lot. So they're active, low body weight. So none of them are actually big in terms of muscularity. None of them are fat either. So they're not big people. They have a close social network, right? And they tend to eat very simply. They eat unprocessed foods, but they don't eat much of it.
Yep.
So if the goal is longevity, it's not to be in zone two or three or whatever. You know, I tell people, if you're training hard for something, like I train fairly hard, intellectually, you know, this has nothing to do with longevity. It's just what I like to do. So when you're, you know, when you talk to people, it's like, well, what are you training for? Because that's the first thing I ask. Well, what's your goal? Well, my goal is I want to run a 5K faster. Or my goal is I want to paddle faster. I'm like, okay, those are easy goals. If someone said my goal is to live longer, I'm like, okay, now we're talking a much different long-term strategy. One, I would lose weight. Even if you're what I call normal weight athletically, I'd say maybe you should lose weight. Maybe you should eat less. Eat no unprocessed foods. And maybe you should live, this might sound odd, but maybe you should live in a small town where you have close friends you see all the time. Versus a large city where, like, if you go to New York City, you live amongst, you know, whatever, 10 million people, of which you don't know any of them because you hate them all. It's, to me, your goals drive everything. You know, is your goal to be a better, you know, stronger power lifter? Everything, you know, converges on that goal. Is your, you know, when your goal is to live longer, that's a different goal. And the strategies actually are a little different. Now, with that caveat, it is true that if you exercise, you live longer than if you don't. So even if your goal isn't longevity, the fact that you work out, the fact that I work out, we're going to live longer than average. Neither one of us is fat or obese, so we're going to live longer than average. And then the rest is genetics. So how long did your parents live? My dad, he lived till his 80s, and he smoked cigarettes since he was 13 years old.
That's crazy.
So I'm thinking, I wonder what would happen if I smoked cigarettes. No. You know, so I'm thinking, I'll live at least as long as him. And he was a smoker for like all his life, yeah. You know, so great genetics there. So I don't know what your original question was. I just sort of kept going there.
That's perfect, because I just wanted to, you covered it all. It's like, there just needs to be this message that there is an almost medicinal aspect to training and exercise that's not being talked about. We talk about it in terms of, or think about it. Not you and I don't. We know the medicinal aspect. We know that, again, it goes back to when somebody says, so you've been working out. I'm like, I want to go. Have you been washing your face? Have you been brushing your teeth? Of course I have. The thing is
for you and I, Jason, we don't think about it. No. Like, we get up and it's just what you're going to do that day, because you do it all the time. But most people don't think that way. And this is where I've wondered about this. I'm thinking, okay, I started exercising. I had an uncle who taught me karate. That's how I first got introduced into training, you know, at like age 10. And I liked how I felt doing it. You know, it was fun doing it. Do you know of individuals who never did any exercise as a kid through high school and college, who picked it up later and stuck with it? I don't know anyone.
Very few. Yeah.
Very few. It's the ones who started young, you know, at least in college, they stuck with it. So, you know, when some 40-year-old, you know, and this is hypothetical, but I've met enough of these people. When a 40-year-old, you know, whether he's a businessman or a soccer mom or whatever, says, hey, could you put me on a training and diet program or whatnot? In my mind, I'm like, you'll never stick to it.
Yeah,
you'll never stick to it. Because at that age, you have so many habits that are ingrained. Are you really going to change it? That's why we have bariatric surgery. We have liposuction. We have all these things that I'm like, you know, if you just worked out, I know it takes longer, but it's better for you.
Yeah. It's so maddening. You remind me of, I wish I had it handy. I'm looking around here. I read a research paper again on the impacts of regular training on your response to COVID. And it talked about the very thing you're talking that you're, and I didn't dig deep enough to find out if what you said.
I read that paper.
And it talked about people that exercised in early age. It specifically said something about that. And I was like, huh, I never even thought about it, but you're absolutely right that it's not because they worked. This is my suspicion. It's not because they worked out in early age. And so that got them through their older years. It's because, well, if they worked out in their early age development, they probably still worked out later in life, right?
Right. They maintained the habit. And also what I found interesting, and this might've been the same paper, was that people who exercise, and I still can't think of mechanistically why this happened, but it was interesting. People who exercise, not only they don't have the poor outcomes of COVID that people who don't exercise, but they're also less likely to get it, which I thought, well, that's really interesting. I don't even know how that works, but I was like, exercise is the single best thing you can do. It still is.
And it goes back to what you said earlier. It's the thing that gets talked about the least. And it's really maddening. I don't understand.
Yeah, you're right. And it's, I think one, maybe because it's hard. Two, people, you know, what's funny. People would rather look at diet as the panacea, even though I think diet's much harder to change than exercise. I'm like, hey, can you exercise, you know, 1 hour, three times a week? That'll help you a lot. Oh, you want to change your diet? You don't have, you know, most people just don't have the discipline to change their diet. But like, for instance, I'm on the Forbes health advisory board, and, you know, Forbes will post stuff on Twitter and on the internet and whatnot. They asked me, you know, could you give some holiday advice that you know, a two or three sentence quote that we could post on Forbes.com? And I'm thinking, you know, there's really nothing here other than the fact that I harp on the single best thing you could do, if you're not doing it now, is to get off your butt and start exercising. That's it. I mean, that's it.
Yeah.
All the other stuff is sort of like, okay, that's sort of a side dish. That's a side dish. That's the dirt. The main course, you got to train. And, you know, I have relatives who, this will show my age, but I remember in college, I had friends that, you know, didn't exercise, and they were thin. You know, I'm like, hey, you know what? I'm telling you, when you're older, it's going to catch up. It's going to catch up. And so now I'm at the age where it's like, college was in the 1980s. And I've seen these friends, and I'm like, I don't want to say it to their face, but I'm like, I'm thinking to myself, God, you're fat.
Yeah.
You're really thin. Now it caught up. It always catches up. But you know, when you're 20 years old, you're like, I can eat whatever I want. I'm this, I'm that. I'm like, it always catches up.
Yeah.
It always does.
And I thank God that I started it at an early age. And here's another thing too, that I've really started to pay close attention to. And I think this is a message that doesn't come out. We are so consumed, especially in America, with comfort. Any form of resistance is bad. If you are not able to get exactly what you want when you want it, then there's some evil, nefarious force keeping you from that, and it must be removed and defeated.
And so we're spoiled.
Oh, man. And the thing is also, Dr. Antonio, that what I've started to really take note of, going back to what we were talking about with our ancestral roots, we were not made for this luxurious habitat. Our bodies were made for a much more aggressive, a much less popular, less food dense, you know, calorie rich atmosphere and habitat. And so I laughed. I wrote something in my newsletter a couple of weeks ago about how I'm sitting here and I'm processing this. I'm writing an article about ancestral living or something to that effect. And as I'm watching a football game, I think at the time, and a commercial comes on, the dude with the deep baritone Arby's voice, the Arby's guy. And he's summoning me to get into my air conditioned car where I don't have to walk. It's air conditioned, to go to the Arby's to grab probably 1500 calories. I didn't have to worry about being chased by a saber-toothed tiger. Nothing. I just go consume it. Yep. Our bodies weren't made for that. Just that lack of resistance to get 1500 calories, you know, and so you've got to account for that. But most people, God bless them, they don't. Right.
Yeah. In biology, we call it's an evolutionary mismatch. The modern society is a mismatch from what we evolved as animals. And it's funny, you know, the 1500 calorie meal that's so easy in Arby's. Imagine 20,000 years ago, it's like, wow, how do I get myself a 1500 calorie meal? I got to expend calories.
A lot of them, man. Exactly. That's the deal. A lot of them. And I just, you know, and I think that's the message. And that's one of the things I hope comes out of this. I hope people stumble upon this and they'll just go, huh, I never thought about that. You know, we were talking about, whenever people ask me, you know, obviously I want them to exercise, but man, I have adopted walking much more. I was kind of the opposite. I was kind of like, for me personally, I was like, you know, I exercise a ton. So walking, that's small ball. No, I've got to exert more energy. Hell no, man. Walking is magical. It's good for your head. It's good for your health. It's just what we were meant to do. And so I now, every day, has at least a 2 mile walk figured in. But the problem with that is, man, that's only, I think I usually knock out a 2 mile walk, and that accounts for maybe 4,500 of my steps, and I want to make sure I'm getting those 10,000 steps. But that's something simple. It just get up and walk, open your door and walk, you know.
Is it warm where you are? Where are you?
So I'm in Tyler, Texas. I'm in East Texas. And
oh, okay.
Not far from where
Dallas.
I know. I was about to say, not far from where you went to, you did some studies at yeah. Southwest. But yeah, I'm about 90 miles from where you were.
And, okay. Yeah. Tyler's it's kind of a cute little town, city. It's
100,000 people. And hey, man, we're getting a 4-year full medical school. You know, here's a little bragging on Tyler. We're the only city outside, city in the UT school system that has both, other than, I guess, Galveston, but now we'll be the only one that has the research hospital, has 4-year university, and now has 4-year medical school right here in Tyler, Texas. Now, it doesn't suck that the chairman of the Board of Regents is from Tyler and is a former state senator and is an incredibly proud UT alum in Kevin Eltife. But yeah, man, it's a great place. It's kind of a medical hub for East Texas, which is why I'm fortunate in that I get to live in a smaller community. I mean, I handpicked Tyler almost 20 years ago to buy a business and raise my children here for the reasons we talked about earlier. This is a healthier environment. And now we have the sophistication. You have 1 in 5 people in Tyler are of the medical profession. And the cool thing is here, you're starting to see a lot more integrative medicine. You're starting to hear a lot more of the things that you and I are talking about.
Right.
And it's cool. And so I want to be a spreader of that message far and wide. So.
Yeah. Well, hey, don't mess with Texas.
That's right, brother. But I tell you what,
I always tell people, just so you know, on my Twitter handle, my description, I put, there's a brief bio and I put, Florida is the single best state. Texas is number 2nd. The rest suck, or something like that.
You did. I know. Oh, I noticed that that's one of the things that attracted me to you. Whenever I reached out, I was like, "Oh, this dude's got some Texas in his blood." Then I saw you at the school down here. I was like, "Oh man, I got to reach out to him." And I tell you though, Florida, you know, for a while it seemed like everyone that wanted to get up and, you know, pull up stakes and relocate, they were coming to Texas. But now you guys, Florida, you know, I'm there every summer. We're destined, folks. So the girls were really little. Oh. They're both about to graduate from college, but go to Destin every year. So I at least spend a little bit of time there. And my youngest, well, actually, both of the girls, I was about to say, one of them split. One has a parent on the West Coast. Their boyfriend has a parent on the West Coast. And now his dad just moved to Florida. And then the other daughter, her boyfriend is from Jupiter, Florida. So, man, I got all kinds of Florida connections.
Wow. You know, the downside to that is property values and property taxes are going way up here.
Oh,
I'm like, oh God, people need to stop moving here.
get ready. I'm telling you, we're dealing with the same thing here. So, well, Dr. Antonio, man, this was a blast. It was exactly what I hoped for. Thank you. And I hope you'll come back.
You're welcome.
I really do. I hope you'll come back on the show. I want to stay in touch with you. I think that there's so much I can learn from you. And again, as I continue down this path of trying to learn as much and glean as much as I can about health, wellness, and then share that with others, brother, I'll probably be calling on you in the future.
Hey, you know what? Hey, since you live in Texas, hey, I'll always keep in touch. So
awesome, brother. Awesome. Well, thanks so much. I'm going to do a quick sign off here and then I'll be right back to say goodbye properly.
Okay.
So with that, folks, there you have it, Dr. Jose Antonio. What an incredible conversation. Thank you so much for being on the show, Dr. Antonio. And thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for watching. If you're watching on the YouTube channel, please, by all means, subscribe. And also go out to jasonrightnow.com and subscribe to the Vitruvian Leather. That's my newsletter that I mentioned a couple of times here, where I just kind of compile all the things that I'm geeking out on, doing research on, like the research that I did on and Dr. Antonio's work. Please just subscribe to that. And also, if you're listening on iTunes, I would be so grateful if you would leave a 5-star rating. With that, I'm Jason Wright. Go endeavor to improve always and always. Thanks.